Why do patients get sick with COPD?
What's really causing this respiratory distress?
We gotta be thinking about this early.
These are patients that can definitely go the wrong direction fast. If the patient's gonna respond, they're gonna respond early, so you can't just walk away and forget about it.
There's no clear winner there. This isn't my bridge to something else.
Welcome back to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. Mike Winters here from the University of Maryland School of Medicine. And this podcast, I am joined by Dr. Peter W. and Dr. John Greenwood. Gentlemen, how are you?
Doing great. Thanks.
Wonderful. Thanks very much, Mike.
Peter, we just got back from a critical point session in Dallas. Definitely an amazing experience and certainly has got all of us excited, looking forward to San Diego coming up, correct?
Yes. So the cusp between November and December in San Diego for critical points, it'll be a great time. Some outstanding faculty.
Super exciting conference. And I know that we've talked about it before on the podcast. So any of you looking for that last CME conference right before the new year, it's truly an amazing location in San Diego. It's one of my most favorite conferences of the year. Really, really great stuff. So please check out our website, link in, and take a look at Critical Points that first weekend in December. Well, to get things going this month, last month we actually talked about ED mechanical ventilation, had some great discussions. Lots of you wrote in with some very, very insightful questions. And as we were talking about topics for this podcast, John, you had a wonderful idea, and that's to actually back up and talk about something right before ED mechanical ventilation in hopes of potentially preventing intubation. And that's a tool that we have in our armamentarium, namely non-invasive ventilation. And as we like to do here on the podcast, link that into a relatively recent or hot off the press article. And it just so happens that there is such a guideline on the use of non-invasive ventilation for acute respiratory failure. So I'm actually going to turn things over to you and have you guide us through this podcast discussion. So take it away.
All right. Well, thanks, Mike. And yes, it was quite timely. This report was actually just published back in July of 2017, and it was by a group of individuals, and it was titled The Official European Respiratory Society and American Thoracic Society's Clinical Practice Guidelines for Non-Invasive Ventilation for Acute Respiratory Failure. So what they wanted to do was essentially go through some of the current indications and update the literature and make some recommendations. So I think the evidence-based indications for choosing non-invasive ventilation remains pretty controversial. There are a few things which I think there's good evidence for, but in large, a lot of it is observational. Traditionally, I think we think of the acute COPD exacerbation, CHF exacerbation, and maybe the respiratory failure in the immunocompromised patients being the primary indications. But despite general recommendations, I think clinical practice has extended the use of BiPAP and CPAP to indications that include other things like acute asthma, patients with mechanical respiratory problems, and other forms of undifferentiated acute respiratory failure. So the panel set out an objective for the guidelines, and that was essentially to provide clinicians with an evidence-based decision tool to address some common clinical conditions where non-invasive ventilation is often used for respiratory failure or respiratory insufficiency. The group did a pretty expansive review, so they examined landmark studies and examined a number of papers up through November of 2016, and in total included about 143 papers. The review team was made up of largely intensivist pulmonologists and respiratory therapists who were all either academic or clinical experts in the field, and they examined the use of both BiPAP and CPAP. And if you read the guidelines themselves, they use some different terminologies for the same thing. They clarify that whenever they use the term bilevel in quotation marks, they're referring to what other people might call BiPAP or pressure support if you're on a ventilator, and CPAP being continuous positive airway pressure. Now, BiPAP in general is designed to provide alternating levels of inspiratory support, so a higher level inspiratory pressure that's provided over a lower continuous end expiratory pressure or PEEP, whereas CPAP is referring to just continuous airway pressure, so a single setting, one and done. So what they did was they developed some PICO questions and used the GRADE tool to assess the quality of evidence, but they didn't necessarily report the exact level of evidence. And they gave some recommendations on how to interpret their recs in particular. If there was a strong recommendation, if they offered a strong one, they said that most individuals should receive the recommended course of action. Adherence to the recommendation could be used as a quality criterion or performance indicator, so something we can look to see how well we're performing, whereas weak recommendations basically imply that there could be some different choices out there that are appropriate for individual patients and circumstances. So they did make 13 recommendations overall, and I think specific to the emergency department or the resuscitation area, we're going to focus on 6 of them that focus more on the acute presentation or acute illness. So why don't we get started off with one of the easier ones, or at least what we think is one of the easy ones, which is hypercapnia with COPD exacerbation. Mike, tell us a little bit about that.
So I get to have the easy indication here in terms of COPD exacerbation and the use of non-invasive ventilation. And I think, as all of us know, we're going to find some pretty strong recommendations for its use. But just to put us all on the same page, why do patients get sick with COPD? And acute respiratory failure in these patients essentially develops when the respiratory muscles fail to achieve some adequate level of alveolar ventilation, despite high levels of diaphragmatic activity and pulmonary hyperinflation. So patients, we know them, their respiratory muscle fatigue leads to the adoption of more of this rapid, shallow breathing pattern that we know we can see with an increased respiratory rate. They're pulling pretty small tidal volumes, and overall it leads to an increase in the arterial concentration of CO2. So once again, hypercapnia, thereby leading to a respiratory acidosis. So the main question with respect to acute COPD exacerbations is, well, should bi-level non-invasive ventilation be used to prevent intubation or as an alternative to first-line endotracheal intubation? And as we would all imagine, this is probably one of the most well-studied indications for the use of non-invasive ventilation. Well over 24 publications were reviewed. And in essence, the authors of this guidelines found that patient response almost universally is seen within the first 1 to 4 hours with the use of non-invasive ventilation or following the institution of non-invasive ventilation in acute COPD exacerbation. There were 2 pretty well done studies that compared non-invasive ventilation to invasive ventilation, and then 4 studies using or examining non-invasive ventilation versus early intubation. Now, importantly, there were some exclusions in those studies, and in essence, patients who had apnea, who needed to be urgently intubated for respiratory arrest, had some degree of psychomotor agitation that required sedation, or were bradycardic with a heart rate less than 60, or were hypotensive with a systolic blood pressure less than 80, in essence, were excluded from the studies that they looked at with respect to these clinical guidelines. And overall, pH is something that we do tend to focus on, and the mean pH in those 4 studies looking at non-invasive ventilation versus early intubation was 7.2. So you can imagine that that's a little bit lower than the studies that were looking at non-invasive ventilation simply to prevent intubation. So in essence, what did the data show? Well, clearly there was a reduction in patient symptomatology, or actually an improvement in how patients felt, a reduction in intubation rates and hospital length of stay, and overall improved survival. So the guidelines give a pretty strong recommendation for the use of bi-level non-invasive ventilation for patients with acute respiratory failure secondary to acute or acute on chronic COPD exacerbations. In terms of the recommendation for intubation and mechanical ventilation, once again, a strong recommendation on a trial of bi-level non-invasive ventilation in patients who were considering intubating and mechanically ventilating in the setting of an acute COPD exacerbation. So overall, the evidence is pretty robust for COPD exacerbations. And importantly, there doesn't appear really to be a lower limit of pH whereby a trial of non-invasive ventilation isn't appropriate. It's certainly something we're paying attention to. The lower the pH, probably the sicker the patient. But overall, thumbs up in terms of the use of non-invasive ventilation for acute COPD exacerbation.
So great points, Mike. I think some of the things that stuck out to me were largely the response time. And I know sometimes for BiPAP, it's easy just to say, put it on and walk away. But clearly, if the patient's going to respond, they're going to respond early. So you can't just walk away and forget about it. You have to check in on your patients. Now, Peter, I don't know, is there anything that makes you feel uncomfortable about starting a patient on non-invasive with a COPD exacerbation? Any type of either clinical criteria or something that you walk in the room, you're like, I don't know if this guy's going to fly?
Sure. So for those patients who are naive to non-invasive ventilation, I like for them to participate and to be conscious and to be coached. through it. And I think that you really find when the patient is alert and can work with you over the initial hour of institution, particularly for those that are naive, that's my marker. I need them to be able to participate.
Great point. Well, then, Peter, why don't we stick with you and move on to the next clinical question that they had, which is the use of non-invasive ventilation for acute respiratory failure due to cardiogenic pulmonary edema or a CHF exacerbation.
Yeah, these are great patients. And I think that there was a recent article in JAM that looked at this and kind of said that less than 20% of the time are we instituting this in the emergency department. So what's really causing this respiratory distress or respiratory failure? And that's decreased respiratory system compliance. And that's due to alveolar flooding. It's just filled with fluid due to high capillary pressures that are associated with primarily left ventricular systolic or diastolic dysfunction. So non-invasive ventilation not only improves the respiratory mechanics, but it also improves left ventricular workload by decreasing left ventricular afterload. So it reduces the wall tension of the LV. It also helps suppress venous return. So it's affecting both preload as well as afterload. So what's the level of evidence here? Where the largest body of evidence has over 30 trials that have been published on the use of non-invasive ventilation compared with standard therapy. A majority are small, really single-centered trials over these past 30 years. There have been 6 single-center randomized control trials that have evaluated the use in pre-hospital setting, but really it appears that effectiveness may be dependent on patient severity of illness or the experience of the ambulance attendants or paramedics. What about the data that's really driving the recommendation here? This is a pooled analysis that really demonstrated that non-invasive ventilation decreased mortality and also decreased the need for intubation in these patients. There is really insufficient evidence to recommend BiPAP over CPAP or CPAP over BiPAP. So there's no clear winner there. Both are effective. The recommendation does not apply to patients with cardiogenic shock or acute coronary syndrome. So again, if you have cardiogenic shock, patients got woeful blood pressure, or if there's acute ischemia going on, we want to avoid this because we've seen increases in rates of myocardial infarction in patients that non-invasive ventilation has been instituted in who are already showing myocardial ischemia. But this level of evidence is not powerful, just really suggestive. So what are the recommendations? We recommend that either bi-level, non-invasive, or CPAP for patients with acute respiratory failure that are due to cardiogenic pulmonary edema. This is a really strong recommendation and has moderate certainty of evidence here.
Excellent review, Peter. Thank you very much. And I agree. I think that the patients with marginal vital signs can definitely be a little bit concerning about starting on non-invasive. Mike, do you have any additional thoughts?
I'd like to definitely reemphasize what Peter just mentioned, that patients with cardiogenic shock and acute coronary syndrome really want to be careful with, as Peter indicated, increased rates of complications, increased MI rates. So definitely pay attention to that group. But as a general rule of thumb, with acute COPD and acute CHF exacerbation, we are hitting these patients hard with non-invasive ventilation. And I think the critical thing for both of these two conditions is you got to be thinking about this early. Often your EMS providers are going to have instituted CPAP in the acute CHF or what they believe is acute CHF exacerbation heading into the ED. As soon as you get that call, let your RT know that you've got a patient coming in, you're going to need non-invasive ventilation, and get everything set up so you can simply transition that patient from the EMS stretcher right onto non-invasive ventilation while you're also preparing your high-dose nitroglycerin.
Excellent point, Mike. I think that pre-hospital non-invasive has definitely been a game changer for these acute patients coming in with COPD and CHF. We're pretty lucky that our EMS crews are fairly comfortable with it in Philadelphia. Peter, EMS routinely using non-invasive in New Orleans?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's one of their major go-to choices. And again, it affects both preload as well as afterload in these patients. So it's a great way to reduce the work of breathing and to promote LV function.
Absolutely. Well, let's move along to maybe a little bit more of a controversial topic, which is the use of non-invasive ventilation, another form of obstructive airway disease, which is asthma exacerbation. So asthma exacerbation essentially causes a couple of things. It's basically a sudden but reversible episode of bronchoconstriction, and that leads to an increase in airway resistance, which clearly causes the patient to feel uncomfortable, have difficulty breathing. And the sudden change of mechanical load, which is largely resistive or obstructive, can generate some similar things to COPD, such as hyperinflation, increased respiratory muscle effort, and feelings of severe dyspnea, which can lead the patient to get tired and eventually tire out and develop hypercapnia. So what did the guideline group think about asthma exacerbation? Well, they only found a few uncontrolled studies and randomized control trials. And unfortunately, the data is mostly retrospective and observational. They did attempt to do a pooled analysis of non-invasive for asthma exacerbation. And what their results showed, it basically demonstrated it has an unclear effect on mortality, intubation, or ICU length of stay. And the studies do show that there's maybe a more rapid reversal of airway obstruction and a reduced need for hospitalization compared to standard therapy. So based on their review of the literature, they gave asthma exacerbation, really, they didn't make a recommendation at all. They said they were unable to make a recommendation for use of non-invasive ventilation. And that, unfortunately, hasn't changed over the past 15 years. Even as I started residency about 9 years ago, now we were talking about and debating the use of non-invasive or BiPAP for acute asthma exacerbation. And I feel like you talk to a different person and they believe something different. They'll say it helps their work of breathing, it helps medication delivery, but unfortunately, there's not enough evidence out there to support the use. Now, what do you guys do? Do you guys routinely use non-invasive for asthma exacerbations? Mike, let's start with you.
Well, first off, I want to point that I'm really feeling old as you were in residency 9 years ago with me at the University of Maryland. Having said that, with respect to asthma, I think this is a great question, and I'm glad that we hit the evidence on this and the fact that it still remains not robust in terms of just retrospective and observational trials. Notwithstanding, I won't use it for everybody, but I will give it a try. And I want to highlight something you mentioned early on, John, that these are the patients where I'm not leaving the room. You know, the COPD, the CHF patient, we're going to get it started. I'm going to be there outside the door. I'm going to make sure they're getting better. But the asthmatic, I'm definitely at the bedside because I want to know in that first 30 to 60 minutes if they're getting better or there's no improvement. And I think my clinical experiences, I found that it works for some, but not all. And so very close observation. And beyond that, is their respiratory rate decreasing? Usually oxygenation isn't a problem, but overall, do they look less diaphoretic? Those are good signs for me, but unfortunately, it hasn't worked universally for all the patients I've tried it on. I don't know, Peter, what's your experience?
I have to echo Mike's thoughts on this and his approach. I don't use it routinely for my asthmatics. However, if you're in a holding pattern and you fail to progress, you fail to improve, I will use it. And again, for the points that John brought up, there are some thoughts that not only does it reduce the work of breathing, but it may also help with deposition of our beta agonists. And so we use that in line. And we've had some success with that. Again, we're hesitant to push to RSI and use invasive mechanical ventilation just for respiratory distress in asthmatics for the hope of turning them around. And so we use this as part of the armamentarium of doing that. But again, I'm looking for asthmatics who are cooperative and can participate in their care.
No, absolutely. I agree. And I think cooperative's the key here. If you have an uncomfortable asthmatic on non-invasive and they're breathing at a rate of 30 breaths a minute, it's really hard to get them not to auto-peep and kind of do some of the things you can accomplish on a ventilator, such as sedate them, slow their breathing down. And so I think you guys hit the nail on the head with staying at the bedside, looking at their respiratory mechanics and see how they respond, because these are patients that can definitely go the wrong direction fast. So I agree 100% that I'm standing close by and keeping an eye on these asthmatics. Well, Mike, let's take a look at maybe a little bit of a different indication, or at least a way to think about why BiPAP is helpful. Let's talk about acute respiratory failure in immunocompromised patients.
Great disease condition to think about this, John. And it's actually been out for a few years in terms of the indication for non-invasive ventilation in the immunocompromised patient, but I don't think it's really widely known within the emergency medicine sphere. In terms of why these patients decompensate, this is very heterogeneous. So we've got immunosuppressed patients from infectious disease, our HIV patients, transplant patients, cancer center patients where they're on chemotherapy. And in these patients, looking at the use of non-invasive ventilation compared to just simply reflexively intubating these folks, is that we know that the effects and the desirable effects of non-invasive ventilation really outweigh the undesirable consequences of initiating mechanical ventilation. Similar to asthma, the literature and the evidence regarding use in this patient population is less robust. Most of the publications are observational, they're uncontrolled studies, and they take a look at patients not on the severe end of the spectrum, but more on the mild to moderate acute respiratory failure. And when we take a look at previous recommendations regarding non-invasive ventilation in the immunocompromised patient, a lot of that is based off of these observational studies where they do find clinical benefit. Unfortunately, some more recent multi-center RCTs haven't confirmed that mortality benefit, the decrease in the duration of mechanical ventilation, or the ICU length of stay. Notwithstanding, the data that they looked at with respect to this clinical guideline, they took a look at pooled analysis that demonstrated that the use of non-invasive ventilation, not clarifying BiPAP or CPAP, use did lead to a decrease in mortality, need for intubation, and the rates of nosocomial pneumonia. So at the end of the day, they give a conditional, not strong, but a conditional recommendation and suggest, not recommend, but suggest the early use of non-invasive ventilation when you've got an immunosuppressed or immunocompromised patient who comes in with acute respiratory failure.
That's great, Mike. And I think this is only a different way of thinking about it. So basically, the risks of intubation are higher than the risks of non-invasive with this group. We're always concerned about ventilator-associated pneumonia and maybe these patients who are already starting out at a higher risk for complications, maybe we should start a little bit more conservatively. But it is interesting that the randomized trials have found no benefit and maybe the early observational data swaying the data in terms of the pooled analysis, but this is a little bit of a downgrade in my eyes. Is something that I was told. You know, at University of Maryland, we had a very high immunosuppressed population, like you said, HIV, cancer. And so this was something we used all the time. But now that it's kind of this conditional because of the recent randomized studies, sounds like a little bit of a downgrade to me. So something worth thinking about. Well, let's move on to chest trauma associated acute respiratory failure. So I think all of us have had at some point an elderly person come in who maybe had a fall from standing down a few stairs and comes in with a number of fractured ribs or maybe even a flailed chest. And the question is, in those patients, should we just intubate them? We know they're at risk for developing pneumonia in the intermediate or short term because of their inability to take a deep breath and to expand their lungs, and they develop atelectasis and eventually pneumonia. So should we, in these patients with impending acute respiratory failure, put them on BiPAP? So I think the utility of non-invasive or CPAP for chest trauma was investigated in three specific randomized controlled trials and a subgroup of these patients in a fourth trial that looked specifically at chest trauma. Most of the studies that looked at this indication were with patients with multiple rib fractures or pulmonary contusions. Now, these trials did have a little bit of a heterogeneous design and different comparators in severity of illness, but what the study group found was that given their pooled analysis, they were able to demonstrate a decrease in mortality, need for intubation, incidence of nosocomial pneumonia, as well as ICU length of stay. So it sounds like a win-win here, especially given your decrease in length of stay and pneumonia rates. So the recommendation was that non-invasive should be used in this patient population, but because there's still a limited amount of evidence, there's not widely studied like the COPD and CHF groups, they still gave it a conditional recommendation with a moderate certainty of evidence. So for chest trauma, strongly consider it, especially in these elderly patients or patients with multiple rib fractures, as it can help the patient take a deep breath and kind of keep those lungs expanded and prevent them from complications down the road. So instead of delving too much further into that, I'd like to get to the last group because this is definitely, I think, the most controversial area, which is the undifferentiated patient with de novo acute respiratory failure. So you have a patient comes in with significant work of breathing. They're brought in by EMS and they're tachypneic with a respiratory rate between 30 and 40. You know they're a little bit hypoxic. Maybe they have a pneumonia, an early flu, or early ARDS. And a number of institutions are still instituting early BiPAP for these patients. So Peter, lead us through this a little bit, and maybe we can talk about de novo respiratory failure a little bit with non-invasive ventilation.
Sure. So this de novo respiratory failure really does refer to respiratory failures without pre-existing chronic lung disease. So these are not your COPD patients, they're not your asthmatic patients, and they're not your patients with congestive heart failure. The goal of the non-invasive ventilation is improved oxygenation that's really facilitating ventilation, decreasing the patient's work of breathing, avoiding any type of intubation, and reducing complications that are associated with invasive mechanical ventilation. Most of these patients have a hypoxemic respiratory failure, so very low PaO2s and SATs. They manifest significant work of breathing, typically with respiratory rates in excess of 30, sometimes 30 to 35 and higher breaths per minute. Many of these patients have pneumonia, as was mentioned before, and some even have ARDS. The recommendations were based on a number of really heterogeneous, uncontrolled studies. So these patient groups are all over the place with multiple etiologies, along with a few randomized control trials, but all really had different endpoints. So it's comparing apples to oranges to lemons to everything between. And so clinical concerns with the use of non-invasive ventilation for these de novo acute respiratory failure. One is that tidal volumes cannot be regulated with non-invasive ventilation. So we're unable to provide lung protective ventilatory strategies for those patients with ARDS or multilobar disease. So our goal of 60 cc's per kilo ideal body weight, we're just guessing with non-invasive. High levels of pressure support can also cause air leaks, can also lead to gastric insufflation, which can complicate other matters. The main risk of non-invasive ventilation for this group of de novo acute respiratory failure is really the delay in the needed mechanical invasive ventilation. And the risk of this failure included higher severity of scores. So what's the poster child for this? Higher severity of illness scores, the older age, ARDS, or pneumonia as the etiology for the respiratory failure, or the failure to improve after 1 hour of treatment. We really shouldn't be flogging them beyond an hour if they haven't turned the corner or at least given some measures that they've improved. Non-invasive failure is an independent risk factor for mortality in this patient population. So when we look at what's the data driving this recommendation, it winds up being a pooled analysis that demonstrated that non-invasive ventilation use led to a decrease in mortality and the need for intubation, although these were both based on a real low certainty of evidence. So the recommendation, given the uncertainty of evidence, it's unable to offer a recommendation on the use of non-invasive ventilation for this heterogeneous de novo acute respiratory failure group.
Great review, Peter. And I think you hit a couple of really important points here, speaking at the dangers of using non-invasive in this group, specifically one, lung protective ventilation. So we talk all the time about getting patients on that lung protective 6 cc's per kilo ideal body weight. But if you're using this pressure support mode, they could be breathing rates, you know, 6, 7, 800 cc's of tidal volume. And if you're not paying attention, you really could be doing some harm. And there's been some discussion about, should we be paying attention to this when we're titrating our non-invasive tidal volumes? And patients are breathing 10 cc's per kilo, or we may be doing a little bit more harm. Mike, any thoughts you have about using non-invasive in all comers with just undifferentiated respiratory failure?
I think this may be one of the most important points that we have of this podcast. And my general rule of thumb is that if a condition isn't rapidly reversible, then I'm very hesitant to use non-invasive ventilation. You think about acute COPD, relatively quick reversible with corticosteroids, bronchodilators, non-invasive. Same thing with CHF and the use of non-invasive ventilation, high-dose nitrates. Asthma, relatively quick turnaround. Now, the one caveat to that is the immunosuppressed patient, but when we apply it to all comers, and especially those that we believe them to have pneumonia or possibly ARDS, as you indicated, Peter, delaying intubation for those that need it for these conditions actually can worsen outcome. And I think that we can't overemphasize that point. These aren't rapidly reversible conditions. ARDS will take a while, pneumonia, and certainly older patients with a lot of comorbidities, they're not going to rapidly turn around. And if we use this or choose poorly and use non-invasive ventilation, then we can really get into trouble. So that's my general rule of thumb for the undifferentiated de novo patient.
Let me just bring one point up that kind of echoes what Mike said. I consider their cardiopulmonary reserve, right? And so if I'm older, if I have poor respiratory function as a baseline, this isn't my bridge to something else. However, if I'm immunocompromised and I'm a young person and otherwise my cardiopulmonary reserve is pretty robust, have a healthy lung, have healthy hemoglobin, have healthy respiratory mechanics, then bridging me with non-invasive or what I use more commonly, high flow humidified nasal cannula, is a reasonable thing to do. But if I'm older, debilitated, have a history of heart disease or anemia, I'm not really bridging. I'm just preventing inevitable intubation, and they're going to quite likely going to be far sicker if I've delayed that, and they'll be less able to tolerate the insult that can be RSI.
Oh, great point, Peter. And I think once you put that BiPAP mask on, and I agree, for your hypoxemic respiratory insufficiencies, high flow nasal cannula, assuming there's no other cardiopulmonary problems, is a great choice. But once you start really relying on PEEP to recruit lung, that's when you start to really get yourself into trouble as you're trying to think about RSI and intubating that patient. We all have seen it happen. We have someone on BiPAP and we have them on 5, 7.5, maybe even 10 of PEEP because we're making some ridiculous thought that, oh, well, their chest wall is just big. They need a little bit more PEEP to recruit. And that's fine. And everything's great until you go to intubate that patient. You take off the BiPAP mask and what happens? Well, their diaphragm comes up, their lungs shrink into size of raisins, and then their saturation goes through the floor and you're left with a really difficult intubation. So I agree. I'm really worried about this patient group. And once I've moved beyond fraction of inspired oxygen and move into PEEP to create an adequate arterial oxygen concentration, I'm getting my intubation box ready. Well, I don't know, guys. I thought that was a great review. I think it definitely updated us on the current literature and where we stand on some of these really good and I think common clinical indications. But I really want to thank each of you for taking the time to go through each of these. I feel like I got a handle on my next shift for some whiteboard teaching pearls, Mike. As a shout out to University of Maryland, I'm following on Twitter and always keeping an eye out for those. But great job overall.
Absolutely. A fantastic discussion. And I think between this non-invasive discussion and then our last podcast on ED mechanical ventilation, I think we've brought our listeners up to speed with respect to the latest evidence, the latest clinical guidelines to really help you in terms of resuscitating these patients with respiratory failure the next time they present to the ED.
Well, then let's wrap this session up and then plan on meeting again in a couple weeks and we'll do it all over again.
Absolutely. Thanks, Peter. Thanks, John. And if you have any questions for us in terms of the podcast, just shoot us an email once again through the website. Thanks for everybody's questions on ED mechanical ventilation. And if you have anything on non-invasive ventilation, we would love to hear your feedback. This is Mike Winters once again from University of Maryland School of Medicine and signing off for CCPM. We will talk to you on the next podcast.